Okay, hello and welcome to this week's Football Fans Podcast. This is the pod that gives real football fans, you know by now, a real voice on the sport that we love. No holding back. We give it to you with honesty, knowledge, but we're always brutal and to the point.
Rather than, well, let's just like, you know, piggyback on London 2012 and then get this stadium just because we want to get the cheap option. And then at some point, we all know that Golden Sullivan is just going to sell it. And Karen Brady just, you know, writes sun columns and doesn't give a crap about anything.
If you can get away with not even paying the staff, like not even get a disrepute charge, not even get, you know, considered, you're still considered fit and proper, then they've got to look about how, about their rules, how they implement them and that kind of thing.
I don't want to get caught up in this Spursy thing because I started it earlier. Spurs fans are not confident, ever. We've got history of messing things up. This is the most quietly confident I've ever been about a Tottenham side. It's the most enjoyable football I've watched, certainly since Bale and Modric were at the club.
My name is Jordan, your host, and just before I introduce my guest for this week, a quick reminder, you can find us on iTunes, Football Fans Podcast, and also on soundcloud.com/footballfanspodcast, and we're going to try and get our flagging and flailing Twitter followers up as well, because I've been really crap on the Twitter feed as well, so we're going to try and get that FFP_11. Subscribe and follow us and all that goodness as well. Right, let me get to my couple of guests this week. We have making his first appearance in person on the FFP, West Ham supporter Kieran. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing very well, thank you, Jordan. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. I've got a bone to pick with you, but you won't care about this one bit. I had Romelu Lukaku on in my fantasy team, triple captained, yep, because he has a record against West Ham. Mm-hmm. I think it's 11-6.
9 games in a row he scored against us.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. I thought triple captaining him, it's a 0-0.
Yeah, that's what happens with football, though, isn't it? When something seems a dead certainty,
it never happens.
It doesn't happen. But you know, he got man marked pretty well on Saturday, and he just had no chance. He was pretty off. So
if he'd have got one goal, I'd have been really pissed off. Yeah, but not even get a goal and have triple captained him.
Full disclosure, I had an accumulator on, which I think possibly for the first time in my life, I bet on West Ham to lose.
Did you?
Which is one of those great situations, because you then sort of have a realisation that it's a win-win, because if you don't...
Yeah.
If West Ham get a point, that's good.
I regularly
And if they lose,
Arsenal.
then boom, you get some money.
Aren't you two in the same fantasy football league?
What, us two?
We are,
actually. I think I'm miles ahead.
Why would you take any advice?
This is true.
I think I had Lukaku in my team, but I didn't put captain or vice-captain. I actually had Benteke as vice, actually, which is quite good.
It's a quiz in for you.
There you go.
Yeah, I'm upset. We're also joined by Spurs fan. This could get quite confusing. Another Kieran, making his actual debut on the podcast. Kieran, welcome. Thanks for coming on.
Hello. Thanks for having me, yeah.
Thanks for coming down.
If you want, you can call me KB.
KB.
Is that easier?
We'll call you KB.
KB, JJB. I've got no B's.
You've got no B's, so you're the one out here. Sorry, mate. All good?
All good.
Considering the weekend, clearly not, but generally all good.
Generally, poor Spurs. We played so well.
We're going to get to Spurs.
He did play very well.
He played excellent. But no one remembers that. apart from Spurs fans. We're going to get to Spurs a little bit later in the pod. We're going to talk about Tottenham Hotspur asking the question, when will they ever step up? We're going to talk about West Ham, and we're going to ask the question...
have they ever stepped up?
Well, I was being generous there. West Ham, who's more important to the club, Bilic or the board? We're also going to talk about stadiums and grounds and find out from you guys where you think the best stadium ground is and what makes a really, really good, vibrant and good stadium. And also, we're going to get a Leighton Orient fan on later as well to talk about the problems that their club are going through too. Before we get into that, I want to just say a very, very quick mention. Obviously, last Friday, the news broke of the passing of Ugo Ekiog, Tottenham under-23s coach, I believe, former Aston Villa, Borough, an England player. And just a brief mention to him, because he's someone that I met on a few occasions just through various FA media and kind of coaching functions and workshops I attended. Really, really nice guy. And I know everyone says that about some of the passes, it's a thing to say, but he genuinely was a really, really nice guy. And from everyone I speak to and spoken to when he was with us, a really bright prospect in terms of coaching. I'm not sure if you knew much about Kieran, his work as a Tottenham coach and the work he was doing there.
I mean, I just saw what all the youth players were saying, and some of the players who sort of broken into the first team in the last couple of years just had glowing.
I think everyone tweeted about him. All the youth players he worked with tweeted about him.
There was a lot of love for him. And Dele Alli dedicated his goal to him.
Oh, did he? I didn't know that.
Touched the armband, pointed to the sky.
Nice.
He was obviously well loved at the club.
Yeah, he was a good man and a definite loss to football and obviously his friends and family. So from the path of the FFP, we pass on our best to his friends and family. Okay, let's go into now some quick drive-bys now, gentlemen. I'm going to kick off with you, Moodley.
Okay.
First question. Do you think there is any value in United extending or triggering Zlatan Ibrahimovic's second year clause, or should they basically just, you know, cut their losses? Is there more value in keeping him than not?
Well, I mean, I think it's quite interesting because the rumour at the moment is obviously that the injury, which is now ruled him out for the rest of the season, could potentially be the end of his career. But I think if you think about how Man United have done this season, I think he's sort of helped them out quite a lot. For a team which has taken quite a while to click, and I don't really see a reason why they wouldn't want to extend it at all because of what he brings to the game, the fact that he can win, he is a match winner, and I think as Rooney sort of slowly sort of, you know, winds down in some ways, Zlatan doesn't seem to wind down at all. So I don't see why there's any reason for them not to extend it.
Expensive contract for someone that might
it's an expensive contract, but it's Man United. They've got the money. I mean, like, it's not like another team who can. Couldn't afford that, and I think he's proven his worth for this team. And as you know, I think Mourinho is looking at the long term and thinking about how this team clicks and what happens next season, especially. And they try to push on from this one, especially as the latter stages of this season have been so much better. So I think it's probably worth the risk. But I mean, they're probably in a much better position to know that because, well, the full extent of what this injury is and whether it is actually, as some sources seem to be reporting, that it could actually be. You know,
could end him in his career. Okay. KB, as you're going to be referred to on this week's FFP, should there be a sacking window in the season for managers? So should there be a window whereby you can only sack your manager in the January window or the summer, or even you can't sack your manager during the season at all?
That is such a curveball because I don't think I've ever thought about that, Jordan, so that's a really good question. I wonder who it benefits. That would be my big point, because that would be seen to be protecting average managers, as far as I'm concerned. I think the transfer window is a complete sham and hasn't benefited football at all.
In that you wouldn't have one, or you would.
I would get rid of the transfer window.
So you could just buy players.
Yeah, I just don't. I just think it makes no sense. It's just added this fake excitement and an excuse for Sky Sports to run something for 31 days, whatever, in the run-up to the end of the transfer window. But I think clubs need that ability. You know, if you see what's happened with Hull, their season was over almost from the beginning, and they managed to get hold of an incredibly talented coach, and it's turned them around. They're going to be a Premier League team probably next year. If you had taken that option away from them, I feel like you're just condemning poorer sides to oblivion.
But if you go back a step, if there's a rule that says you can't sack mid-season, I mean, my feeling clearly wasn't good enough to manage Hull. If owners know that that's the rule, you can't sack mid-season, do they not then have to then employ? Their recruitment's got to be better then. They might not have employed Mike Feeling in the first place because they know if this goes wrong, we're stuck with him for the season.
Yeah, but I mean, it just seems so arbitrary. I mean, that doesn't happen in any other industry, does it? You don't stop businesses getting rid of people who are not performing very well. And I think, you know, Leicester's another example. Who would have thought that Claudio Ranieri was going to lose his job halfway through the season? Absolutely no one. That said, if he'd stayed, there was a chance they were going to get sucked into a very serious relegation battle. And again, you know, their turnaround's been complete. So no, I'm against it. I'm coming out and saying it. I'm against it.
Against it. Okay, nice. Stick with you, KB.
Okay.
Watford are currently 10th in the Premier League, but no one seems to talk about Materazzi, the manager there at Watford. He doesn't seem to get any kind of credit, and it kind of seems to be a bit under the radar, the job that he's done there. Whenever I seem to see Watford play, they seem to lose, but yet they're 10th. So I'm like, how is it every time I see you on the TV, how much that you've lost, yet you're 10th, you're quite clearly comfortable, and I think they're above teams like Stoke and Palace and West Ham that have kind of spent big money and more established, sorry Kieran, in the league. Do you think he deserves more credit than what he is currently getting?
I think he probably does. I think he'll probably get sacked.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's his credit.
It doesn't seem to matter what what a coach does there. Was it Flores before? Mm. I thought was a, you know, absolutely
job.
Adequate. Yeah, he was doing very well, keeping them comfortably. I mean, I don't know if they were as high as 10th, but they were certainly safe.
I think they're about 12th, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it seems to be that the strategy is to keep things disrupted, keep everyone on their toes, mm. which breeds better performances mm-hmm. season by season. And it's worked, so, mm. you know, I don't want to say it's total nonsense, but I don't understand the idea that they're good coaches. Materazzi as well has got a heck of a reputation.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So why wouldn't you want to build something with him?
Yeah.
And yet, because of the way that the club's run, the speculation is constant. It seems if he goes two or three games without winning, then his job's on the line. But no, he probably does deserve a lot of credit. It's just that I think there's probably managers with fewer resources who've impressed slightly more than him this season. Again, Hull, Silva was doing such a remarkable job. So I feel for him because
it's a lose-lose.
I don't know what Watford board want. I don't know what would be considered a successful season or if it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You know, that's just the strategy they employ.
Okay. And back to you, Ridley. Of the three strikers I'm about to name,
mm-hmm.
if you had to take one at West Ham, which would it be? Deeney, Josh King, Salomon Rondon.
Okay, well, I'm going to instantly say... Well, okay, caveat, any striker...
who says there's a caveat?
Well, here's the caveat. Any striker who comes to West Ham is instantly just going to become crap.
Okay, that's happens. Caveat, fair enough.
I think, we've had 31 under Golden Sullivan since they took over in 2010. They've bought 31 strikers.
Jeez.
And I think they average about 4 goals.
Wow.
Each. So I think out of that, I wouldn't have Rondon. Josh King scored a hat trick against us.
Did that go against him? Was that a reason why you might take him?
So that sort of leaves a scar. I think I'd probably take Troy Deeney. I think he just might be the kind of player which would fit in a bit more with West Ham. So I think, not thinking about it too much, I would instantly take Troy Deeney just because I think he's a proven goal scorer. And I think that's what West Ham needs the most, is someone who will just score goals rather than someone who's a, you know,
streaky striker.
Yeah, or someone who's... You just need a proven goal scorer. I mean, if you look at the game against Everton at the weekend, it's just a perfect point of, we didn't look like we'd concede, but we didn't look like we'd score. People are too scared to shoot, mainly because when they do eventually shoot, they can't shoot. And that's just been the problem with us for the whole year, really. So I would take Troy Deeney.
Fair enough. No interruptions. No interruptions.
I really wanted to interrupt his last one, actually.
I know you did. That's what's weird as well.
I had a really good point, by the way.
Save for next time.
Sure you did.
All right, guys, let's get now into... let's just briefly kind of touch over the FA Cup semis on the weekend.
Do we have to?
Well, we're going to take Tottenham out of this because Tottenham have got their own little section later on, so we're going to kind of just talk very briefly about the three other semi-finalists. I'll start with you, Kieran Moodley. Arsenal semi-final win.
Yep.
What does it mean? Because I'm struggling to work out as an Arsenal fan what this means. Does it mean that Arsenal are not actually as bad as the previous 3 months have shown us, or is it just an isolated good performance and result?
I think it shows that there is a level of fight and confidence in the Arsenal team, which hasn't been there for a while. Because I think, if you think about it, this is definitely, well, it must be, the longest sort of poor streak of form under Wenger. I mean, if we take it from, I mean, I don't know where the streak begins, but let's say it's like, you know, the 5-1 against Bayern away?
Before that, I think it was 6,
because that was like early Feb. So we're talking, you know, we're going back quite, you know, 2.5 months. Yeah. This has been one of the, you know,
and
it's
you
been
had the 3-3 against Bournemouth. Bournemouth, wasn't it?
Yeah, but I mean, that showed fight in the fact that you can come back, you know, from 3-0 down. Yeah. I mean, it was bad. I mean, Arsenal shouldn't be in that position anyway, but it shows that there's something in it. But I think what this result, I think it's a really good positive result. And actually, as someone who admires Wenger and supports Wenger, which, you know,
I don't.
I know you don't, and I know lots of my Arsenal supporting friends would like have an issue with that. And it's not necessarily my place to say because I'm not an Arsenal fan. I haven't been through it all. But I think what this is really important is, it can't be a coincidence that if Chelsea win the league, you will have two teams the two previous teams to win the league weren't in Europe. Arsenal fans seem to think that you know, it's all about, or the Arsenal board specifically seems to think that it's all about finishing in the top four. And part of Arsenal fans' problem is not just not winning the Premier League, but it's also the fact that it's always losing in the knockout round of the Champions League. I kind of feel that winning this FA Cup, if they do, is the confidence boost which gives Wenger the ability to sign that contract. And I think if Arsenal finish outside the top four, that should not necessarily be seen as a bad thing. It should be seen as a new chapter where, without having the distraction of Europe...
We'll still be in Europe because we'll likely finish fifth.
Yeah, so you've got the Europa, but I mean... Well, I mean, it'd be interesting to see how Arsenal deal with Europa. I mean, I do. You should just do a West Ham and just, like, get out of it straight away.
Well, of course.
Yeah. Even though West Ham didn't mean to do that. But I feel like there's an opportunity there for Arsenal to sort of say, you know, we went through this really... I just find it so weird with Arsenal that you've had this manager for 20 years and you go through one really bad period and it's like, let's just get rid of him. Like, this is the... And I know you can go through the whole, like, the last 12 years of all this kind of stuff. I just feel like this, you know, getting that FA... Beating Man City proves that there's still some fight in Arsenal and that they can beat teams, even when they're just gone through a really bad streak. I mean, you know, you've beaten a Man City, a Pep Guardiola side. So I think it's an important victory for Arsenal. I think they'll probably push on and probably win all the rest of the next games. I think it's a good position to push on for next season where, you know, if you know this is going to be Wenger's last 2 years. So this is like the ultimatum which he needs, which is... Because Arsene Wenger's always been comfortable because he finishes fourth and he's like, I'm fine.
Yeah.
If he doesn't finish in the top four, which he most probably won't, It puts him in that position where he really has to prove himself. He himself knows that the guillotine's hanging over his head and he has to do something in the next 2 years.
Is that not the chop that should kind of send him away? Because as you said there, his whole big thing is, I do get top four. Top four's not easy to get. I get it every year. Does not finish in fifth or sixth, is that not a sign of you're actually now going backwards and it's official?
Yeah, but I mean, but then he could also just argue, but I finished fourth for the last 20 years, you know, one season, and now he instantly want to have a go at me. I mean, like, I've never been one to like clubs which just sat in the manager all the time. I mean, there's the other argument, which is you can't keep on to them as long, but there's definitely a positive, as you've seen with Arsenal, that if you have a long-term manager, it really is beneficial. And also, I mean... Arsenal is the reason why Arsenal expect stuff, because Arsenal before weren't like that. Yeah, they won the league like in the late 80s, but he's made them into that club. Like, they expect trophies.
Now we expect
because,
too much.
Yeah, almost. Now you expect too much. So I think there's he's earned respect, and he's earned, I would argue, another 2 years.
Okay.
I mean, I agree that it would be crazy for them to get rid of him, but I think there are huge risks in giving him a 2 year contract because... Jordan, I'm sure you'll agree, Arsenal have got to spend a lot of money to catch up. They might not have European football next year, but it doesn't matter because their team isn't good enough to win the league.
Is that a problem? Is spending a lot of money to catch up? We don't have Man United money, but we've got money to spend $200 million.
No, you've got money, but the problem is, do you want Arsene Wenger to spend it? If he's only going to be there 2 years and there's not full trust in his signings of late, I mean, okay, fair enough, Sanchez knows all. On balance have been very good signings. Sanchez has been exceptional. Ozil probably
less so,
but you know, I mean, he's had runs where he's been absolutely the most influential player for you. It's just whether or not, you know, you go out and spend 100 million 200 million this summer, do you trust Wenger to spend that money well?
I personally don't, and the thing that's worrying for me about Arsene Wenger is that I'd go one step further than that. Even if Wenger does bring in the players that I think we need to bring in, I doubt his ability to make a player better. So even if he went and bought Aubameyang, if he went and got Brand, if he then went top players, I'd be worried that he'd kill them. I'd be worried that he'd make them rubbish. So I don't. Not only do I not trust him to spend money on players, even if he bought in the right players, Ozil, Cech, Welbeck, these are good players. They've come to Arsenal and they just look so bad. So I would be worried about him spending the money, full stop. But then people say, okay, what if he bought the players that you wanted, Jordan? And I'm like, well, that'd be great, but I'd be anxious that, are you going to ruin this player that I want somehow? Because you've shown in the past two or three years that players are not progressing under you.
That said, you know, and this is the Spurs fan in me, you could go and win every game you've got left. And I still, until we are mathematically... out of St. Torring's Day.
You still don't think...
Seriously, no, you don't.
This,
you don't get it.
This is really Spurs fan.
This is 21
They're
years.
They're clearly going to push up our Arsenal this year. Well, clearly,
I'm not. Mate, we said that last year.
I had only like
11 at the moment.
Is that only 11? I thought it was more.
It was 14.
I thought it was more than that.
I think you closed.
I think it might be more than that now.
I think it's more.
It's 11 or 14. Either way, it's not enough.
It can be 25.
Absolutely not enough. There's still 21 points to play for, and I, you know, less than now for us. You know, I. After the weekend, which we played really well in, and I'm sure we'll come on to that, I will never be confident. You know, I'm still not confident we come second. So we've got a really tough run in.
Yeah.
We've got, you know, form sides, Crystal Palace on Wednesday.
We'll save it on that.
Yeah, I'll save on that. But going back to Arsenal, they didn't even play that well on Sunday. That said, they could go and beat Chelsea in the final. It's a one-off game. Anything can happen. A lot of the Arsenal fans I've spoken to, their frustration is that even if he goes now, it's too late, in the sense that whoever comes in has got a huge rebuilding job to do and to catch up. And
but why not start it now? Why wait 2 years to start
it? I think the argument is, who do you go and get? Because a lot of the good young coaches have already gone to other clubs. I mean, looking at Europe now, Simeone maybe.
Arsenal can get pretty much. The argument I've said on the pod so many times, the point that people say to me is, who do you get? It's a myth. If Arsenal were serious about wanting to get a manager, there's probably only about 4 or 5 managers in world football Arsenal can't get.
Okay.
Mourinho, Pochettino, Pep Guardiola, Klopp and Ancelotti. I think those 5 aside, if Arsenal were serious, they could go and get Simeone.
So that's who you'd want to get?
My choice would be Koeman. And I've wanted Koeman for about 18 months. I'm a big fan of Koeman. But Simeone would be the kind of obvious person that would just shake the house up and just make a lot of noise.
So do you think it would be instant, the impact?
I wouldn't mind if it wasn't. As long as I saw a manager...
Yeah, but all Arsenal fans say that. But I mean, the fact...
Three games and they start...
But the thing is like, what is the hurry? Like, I mean, okay, it's... There's a
hurry is a Tottenham on the rise.
But this is what I was saying about before. It's Arsenal put you in a position for the last 20 years that you've been above Spurs, right? And the minute you're behind them, you're like, no, everything's got to change. It's football, right? It's been going on for like 120 odd years. Like, it happens. At times, Spurs are going to be better than Arsenal. Like, and this generation of people who've grown up with Arsenal, not only do they love him, but they also just can't stand not winning the league and finishing below Spurs. At some point in the history of the Premier League, it is going to happen. And okay, it happens now. Like, that doesn't necessarily mean there has to be this, you know, sort of rush to completely like freak out, because it's only Spurs as well.
It is only Spurs, yeah. I mean, but Spurs aside, I mean, Arsenal shouldn't be judging their standards by Spurs. Are not. But the bigger picture is, I think Arsenal are frustrated that they're just not competitive. Whether Spurs finish above us or not, we're not competitive. We're just not. It's a repetitive problem.
But I think in the past, when so Wenger's never been under pressure like he has now, right? And at times when he's felt like, oh, he's got to try and like please these people having a go, and he's like, right, I'll buy Ozil, I'll buy Sanchez. The idea that you now have potentially quite an exciting moment where he actually is going to go out and really buy a whole new set of players and give him the opportunity to see what happens in the next year or 2 years. And then if it doesn't work, well, then you get a new guy in who's actually got some new, better talent rather than the current situation. I just feel like I don't feel that the argument to not allow that to happen and to just give it another 2 years. And, you know, I mean, Spurs have been going through like, you know, these 20 years of transitioning and trying to get it's not going to be as, you know, as long as that, because, you know, Arsenal don't do, you know, don't do a Saturday and don't Spurs things up. But I just
Hold on.
I don't see.
I'm not. No, rubbish. Absolutely rubbish.
But you know, I just, you know, I'm a Wenger fan. I just don't, and like,
okay,
and you know, with my West Ham hat on, there are a lot of other supporters of other clubs who would, you know, give their right arm to have Wenger.
Okay.
Or to have had the experience of having like Wenger.
Right. I think the final point is that football has changed a heck of a lot since Wenger took over, and the big shift is just this sheer amount of money that the Premier League has, which has allowed clubs to catch up with Wenger, to employ a lot of the things that he brought to the Premier League. Every club has the same kind of coaching setups, the incredible infrastructure to develop young players, and the funds now to go out and buy players who are, you know, would have been 15 years ago out of the reach of, you know, 75% of clubs in the Premier League. that's caught up Arsenal in a really big way and in a damaging way. But it's also probably the saving grace, as Kieran says. If you did get rid of, if you keep hold of Wenger for 2 years and he spends a lot of money, you're still going to have loads of money in 2 years' time.
Yeah, it's true.
And whoever just comes in is going to be able to spend a whole heap more money on different players. And
yeah,
I think that's probably the most frustrating thing for Arsenal fans, is that it's obvious what's happened in the Premier League, mm-hmm. and yet Arsenal stuck to the same rigid structure.
Okay, let's move on. Bring in Pep slightly here. Did you guys watch the semi-final, the Arsenal game?
I did.
Yesterday?
I watched a bit to it.
Do you feel that, I was on the train on the way back and I saw the highlights when I got home. Do you feel, Kieran, that Wenger won that final by what he did, or did Pep lose the final, sorry, semi-final by what he did? Because I was listening on the radio on the train back and it sounded like he made some really weird substitutions, and tactically there were some things that were very Pep-like that looked like they were just crazy. Or do you think on this instance Wenger just out-tacticked him?
I think Wenger got his tactics right in that. I think often it feels with Arsenal, they haven't really got a game plan when it comes to like the big games, which is why they often fall short against the top fours and the top sixes. Like, they do the sort of Arsenal pretty passing sort of thing and not really necessarily think about their opposition and sort of trying to soak up pressure or trying to outmuscle them. And I think that's just essentially what happened in the end. Combined with the fact that I think there does feel with Pep this sort of resignation, which I think he admitted a few weeks or months ago, that he's got the most out of this side. Like, it feels like he's sort of resigned himself to this squad is
he's
not
got
as,
one eye on next year.
Yeah,
already,
this squad is not as good as I want it to be. I've taken it as far as I can. I'm just waiting to the summer to have a complete overhaul. Similar to you know what we're saying about Wenger, it's good for him to not have a top four because it puts pressure on him. I think it's probably good for Guardiola that he now hasn't got, for the first time in his managerial career, a trophy at the end of a season. Like,
refocus the mind.
Yeah, exactly. And I just think, I don't think Guardiola necessarily was that interested in the FA Cup.
Okay.
I think, whereas Wenger, I think it was, you know, I've got to get this right, and this is technically the FA Cup is the only thing which could possibly, you know, legitimise me signing a new contract.
Well, just Kieran, bring you on this one. Just last point on Arsenal and Wenger. Do you get this impression that Wenger likes the FA Cup more than the league? Because I looked at his reaction when we won the game, and it was really, really animated in a way that I've never seen him be that animated for a long time for a league game. He's won the FA Cup now 5 times, I think it is. He's been to so many finals. Do you get the impression that he genuinely, for some reason, loves the FA Cup in the way that he's not obsessed with the league? Or am I just kind of clutching there?
I think this season, definitely. I mean, when you're so... I mean, let's be honest. They haven't put a title bid together how many years now?
It's been a while.
Seven years?
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not surprised he's desperate for a bit of silverware again, given the pressure he's been under. Yeah, and you can laugh. I'd like a bit of silverware too.
Desperate for silverware?
Yeah.
That sounds familiar.
Coming from a West Ham fan, I'll take it from Jordan, that's fine. That's absolutely fine. Going back to the Pep thing, though, because I actually don't think Arsenal got it right tactically. I mean, you win, fair enough. It doesn't matter. But Man City should have scored 4 goals. In the second half alone, and Arsenal in the first half were woeful. I don't think they got out their half.
I heard people really poor in the first half. Yeah,
awful. I think City had 70-odd% possession. Now, fair enough. You don't use that. You don't score goals. Then you know, maybe you have been tactically outclassed. But it seemed more luck than skill that game.
No, no trophy in his first season in England. He spent a lot of money. He's made some really big decisions. We've done a kind of couple of times this season on the pod. We've analysed Pep Guardiola and how he's doing. I said on the pod about 3-4 weeks ago that I don't think he'll win a Premier League title, simply because I think his tactical way of playing is not conducive to win the Premier League. It works abroad. It just won't work here. I don't think he'll win a Premier League. He might win the Champions League at City. I don't think he'll win the Premier League. Is it time now to start asking some serious questions of Pep Guardiola, albeit in his first season? No title bid, no trophies.
It's interesting because I think the competitiveness of this league must have surprised him. I mean, everyone must have warned him it's not the same as Germany and Spain. You're not going to have, you know, 20 games a year where you basically just have to turn up and you're going to win. And also, the players he's dealing with are not as good. Mm-hmm. You know, he's dealt with... I mean, I watched the El Clasico last night. Mm-hmm. as good as the Tottenham-Chelsea game was on Saturday, last night's quality, I was just dumbfounded by the pace, the skill, the guile, the creativity of every player on the pitch from defence going forward. It was just incredible. Mm. The standard was outrageous. And he's not, I mean, he's got Otamendi at the back. So, Clichy. So, it's going to take a while for him to get a side that can do what he wants them to do. And he might never get it because, I don't know, you'd have to spend a lot of money to get the players that he needs.
I mean, there's a problem if your best chance to make it 2-2 in an FA Cup extra time falls to Fabian Delph.
Of all the parts of the team that you think they should be okay in, going forward is not an issue. I mean, they've got the best front six of anyone by a long way. And he took off Aguero for Delph.
I think the only people who probably be disappointed with this season, obviously Man City fans, but it's probably the board. Because, I mean, obviously the board are like, you know, get rid of Pellegrini because he only won us the League Cup last year. So we have to get rid of him. And now we've got a new manager who doesn't get anything. So I think in those standards, it's probably a failure. I think, but I don't think you can write him off just in this first season. And I think what Kieran was saying is right in that if you look at the league now, it's so interesting if you look at the league how you've got a massive divide from the top six, and then I think the top seven, and then there's like a 15-point gap between like Arsenal, whoever it is, going down to like West Brom, and then you've got a big clump of all those teams. It's like what you're saying with Watford. The reason why Watford are there is because you can lose loads of games and still, like, if West Ham win their next game and everyone else loses, we go up to like ninth. There's like this clump of like mediocre teams who can just about avoid relegation because of the new TV money, and then you've got that whole chunk of all those teams who are really competitive, it's not like, you know, it's not Barca, Real and Atletico, that's it, you know. It's
and also,
and as Everton get better, you know, there's that whole, it's a really competitive league,
and also anyone outside of that top seven can beat you.
Yeah. And the TV money means that even though they're languishing, they can still do a Palace and just come out and beat, because they have the means to get good players.
How do Arsenal beat Chelsea? Let's move on to Chelsea now. How are Chelsea beaten? What's the way to beat Chelsea?
I mean,
well, Spurs managed it early in the season.
The way we did it was 2-0. Pressing the hell out of them in their half. Putting pressure on their centre-backs. Basically, if you don't let David Luiz dictate from the back and you can keep Kante and Matic quiet, you've got a good chance. And we did. For the majority of the game, that's exactly what we did. Mm. And they didn't really look like scoring until we gave them two goals in the first half, and then they scored two wonderful goals in the second half, and an absolute worldie from Matic. How many games have they lost this season? It's five, isn't it? Four or five. You've either got to soak it all up and hope to hit them on the break. Maybe that's what Arsenal will do, because I don't think they've got the team to press.
But I don't think they've got the team to necessarily soak it up as well, have they?
I mean,
Chelsea, not as good as
Spurs. Of the two teams, Chelsea would have wanted Arsenal. I don't think there's any question.
Of course, yeah. Is there not something in your point that I think the four or five games they have lost this year, I'm just thinking, they've all had relatively quick attacks. So Palace with Zaha, yes, yeah, punching. Benteke is not quick, but He can put a shift in. Arsenal beating 3-0. I think that gave that day Walcott. Sanchez was up top. You beat them. You haven't got the quickest team. But you press well.
It's the press. It was getting possession.
United beat them last week with Rashford and Lingard up top. So is that the way to kind of really, like you say, put it on Luiz and make Kante and Matic have to come deeper and deeper for the
ball?
That's
it. You take those two into their own half and out of the game. If you can stop them linking up with the Hazard, you can isolate Hazard. Mm-hmm. You got a chance. Costa isn't firing at the moment. You got a chance. I mean, I think the problem is, as we found out on Saturday, if you can take 200 million quid's worth of bench and put it on and change a game, you've always got a chance, haven't you?
Yeah,
and
you do.
No one's got that squad depth at the moment. Chelsea have got the best squad depth, I think, in the league. Mm-hmm. With City would be the only team that come close.
Yeah,
it's going to be really tough. That said, though, cup final.
It's a cup final. Come on, pressure, I believe it's cup final. Can I have a cup final?
I put money on Arsenal.
Ooh. Is that because you know there'll be longer odds and you got?
and then you have the satisfaction if they don't win.
Yeah, it's fine.
I mean, the good thing is also there's a whole month ahead. Months to
anything can happen.
Prepare for it as well.
They could be the form team by the time they go into it. That's genuinely, I wouldn't be surprised. Arsenal's done it before. When the pressure's on him, the team goes and puts a run of seven games together.
I mean, it could definitely like play into Arsenal's hands.
And then suddenly they're title contenders again next year.
Yeah, we're gonna win the league. Last couple of quick ones on the semi-finals. Matic, does he only score like worldies? I was thinking, like, the goal he scored against your mob on the weekend, a great goal. I remember a goal he scored against Everton about two seasons ago at Goodison Park when they beat Everton 6-3. It was, like, 35 yards. He scored another worldie, I think, against Stoke last season. He seems to only, like, score, like, 35-yarders or nothing.
It was amazing.
He said it wasn't even his
best
goal.
Yeah, it was a goal at Benfica.
His Benfica goal against Sporting. So he scores in big games as well. Yeah. It was an absolute blueser, a top left corner.
It was so good.
Yeah, he's a very talented boy, isn't he?
And Fabregas, finally, does he have to leave, Kieran? Do you think he has to leave in the summer now? Because I am and always have been a massive fan of Cesc Fabregas. He's clearly too good to be a bit part player in any team.
Yeah. I guess it depends on what Conte does with the squad over the summer. And where Fabregas feels his place would be, or where he feels he can go to. I mean, how old is he now? Fabregas, he must be early. Is he early
30s? Yeah, I think he's about 30.
He's touching 30,
I mean, it hasn't worked out that badly for him. He gets a Premier League title, and I guess he'll sort of reconsider where he wants to be, but I'm sure he'll definitely want to finish his career somewhere where he's getting first team football. And if Conte doesn't allow that, then maybe he will leave.
Right, guys, let's move on now to talk about your beloved West Ham, Mr. Moodley. Let's start with a question, Kieran. Who's better for West Ham United in the long term? What's better for the club? Slaven Bilic, the manager, or the board? Because it seems to be that the two don't seem to be working in complete harmony in moving forward. There seems to be some kind of friction between the two there that they both want to admit to. Or I just misread that completely?
Well, I don't think I don't think either are particularly great in the long run.
Great.
I mean,
I was going to say this could take a while.
I am Mr. Pessimist when it comes to West Ham.
Go for it.
I mean, okay, so I've always never been a great fan of Bilic, and I always have always been a bit of a big Sam fan, which a lot of West Ham fans hate. Even though one could point out at the moment that Crystal Palace are now above us, and I think with a game in hand, so 2 years after sacking Sam, he's now above us. So that worked out. The thing about Bilic is, so in the long run, I don't understand with Bilic is that people say give him some time, he needs better players, or to sort out the fact that we have like one of the worst defenses in the league, but we've had a really bad defence in the league for a very long time. And if you take someone like Conte, obviously he's got a much better squad on his hands, but when they lost 3-0 against Arsenal, he was like, right, let's sort this all out, rip it all up, let's start three at the back, boom. And they've been great ever since. West Ham lost, you know, 4-2 against Watford back in, when was that, September? They then lost 4-2 against West Brom. They then lost 5-1 against Arsenal. And at no point were they like, wait a minute, we need to sort this out. Or has there been no pressures of let's try and like, you know, you've got every club, you've got to work from the back anyway. And then you lose 4-0 against, then you lose 5-0 against Man City, then 4-0 against Man City. You lose 3-0 against Arsenal. There's been all these, like, there's just an inability, it seems, from Bilic to sort out the defence. Okay, we had a 0-0 at the weekend, so it's got a little bit better. But, you know, we still let, you know, Bournemouth hadn't won a game all 2017, and then we lost 3-2 against them. Sunderland hadn't scored in 2 months, and then they managed to get 2 goals against us. So with Bilic in the long run, is that if he can't sort out the basics and he's been given a whole season, I don't necessarily see how it's going to get that much better next season, because he clearly can't do even the basics. And the defence was pretty bad last season. We were doing better last season because we had Payet and he had... we were just playing a lot better. So every time we let in 2 goals, like against Man U in the last game against at the Bolin, we scored 3. So it was always offset. With the board, you have a problem where they seem incapable of knowing where and how to spend money. You spend £8 million on Jose Fonte. He hasn't been that great. I think it was like £10 million on Snodgrass. £20 million on Andre Ayew, who's been absolute pants all season. So they clearly have this sort of, I mean, it's a whole argument of this, why businessmen think that because they're really good at running a business, they're really good at being in charge of a football club, because they clearly don't sometimes know how to do it. And they clearly don't know where to spend the money in the right way. And they've, and with the ground, there's been this sort of like, well, let's get into this ground because it's a good deal. Let's, you know, it's a kind of thing where, at least with Arsenal and Spurs, there's this sort of sense of like, well, we're not going to try and get a cheap freebie ground. We want to try and get our own ground, which we've thought about in some way, rather than, well, let's just like, you know, piggyback on London 2012 and then get this stadium just because we want to get the cheap option. And then at some point, we all know that Golden Sullivan is just going to sell it. And Karen Brady just, you know, writes Sun columns and doesn't give a crap about anything. You know, it's become so much more. I feel West Ham has become so much more of a brand, this sort of like PR exercise for them, yeah, rather than a football club.
You've pretty much answered all my points in one, but I was going to drop the mic.
Guilty.
But I was going to pick up your point about business and businessmen owning clubs. I find interesting as well, because you're right. In business, the most successful businessmen and women become successful because they have an idea of what the product or what the service is, but they get the people in that are specialists in areas to do the job that they possibly can't do to the best of its ability. But you're right, in football, they seem to think, well, I'm a businessman, I'm going to buy this club, and I'm going to run every element and every area of it, even though I clearly don't know about recruitment and all these sorts of things. So you're right, it's a really weird concept for business people.
Also, there's this, I just don't, you know, why does David Sullivan, just because he's like a rich guy, think that he knows who are the best players? You know, he came out and said all that. You remember when we were thinking about getting, who was that striker we were getting? Was it?
He
made that comment about him always having a busted knee, and he just like,
Austin.
Yeah, Charlie Austin. He just like, he said that, and it was just like, well, why are you saying that? You're just making all this stuff about him being injury prone, and you're the guy who bought Andy Carroll. So what are you talking about? And all the news which comes from West Ham comes from your son's Twitter account. Yeah. It's just ludicrous. But I mean, having said that, you know, you look at someone like Spurs, and you know, Levy knows what he's doing. I would assume he is a better version of how you have a good businessman who knows how to run a club. It just seems that we got the bad, dodgy ones. Cause
what would you want, though? What's the answer in the short term? I mean, you don't like Bilic. You've made that pretty clear in our discussions about West Ham. But do you get rid of him? And if you do, who are they going to bring? Who do you trust Sullivan and Gold to do a better job next time?
Well, I mean, things would have been a lot different if Benitez had come, which is what was meant to happen, and then he got the Real Madrid offer. I mean, the problem is that with Golden Sullivan, I don't necessarily trust them that much in terms of getting a good manager, because, you know, they bought the club and kept Zola there for a little bit, and he just kept us up, and they got rid of Zola. And I think, as we've seen with Birmingham City, he's not that great a manager. So maybe that was a good idea. But then they replaced him with Avram Grant, who then, you know, got us relegated. You know, these owners can say that they're really good and they've, like, you know, you've got rid of our debt and they've moved us into the stadium and it's great. But they also do make bad decisions. You know, they got Avram Grant. They got us relegated. It wasn't the previous owners, it was them. So I don't think sacking Bilic is what we should do. And I think we should give him at least another half of the next season to see whether he can prove me wrong and he can make things a lot better. But I think, as with any club, if you're going to sack the manager, you have to have a decent replacement who you've actually thought about. You know, and the problem with West Ham, there are always so many rumours going around, which the club themselves like to, you know, spread themselves. But, you know, Benitez wanted to come. I don't know how happy he is at Newcastle, but
pretty happy. He's doing all right at the moment.
Well, apparently he's not that happy. They didn't let him spend that much in January, I thought. So
which I thought was a bit out of order of him, because if that squad is clearly good enough to walk the championship, so
you
if
don't
you
need to spend
more,
any more money,
then it's like you're something wrong. So Jordan goes to look for his notes for things that Kieran hasn't already touched on. Andy Carroll, yep, you mentioned him. The owners talking too much on Twitter, yep, you've mentioned that. The stadium, yes, you've mentioned that. Will better
boxes.
Players make any difference? No, you've answered that as well.
Taking boxes.
Bilic's management.
I've got a question. It's in defence of Bilic, actually. You're talking about how... This is about how defensively you are suspect. The difference is, obviously, that you're not playing football in the attacking third as much anymore. And so there's a lot more pressure on your defence this season. And there is one big reason for that, and that's the fact you sold the best player you've had in years because he didn't want to be there anymore. And it was the right thing to do. But reorganising your team after you've lost your talisman, as a Spurs fan, I can tell you how difficult that is because we've done it many times. And it does totally disrupt the balance of a team. And if you're
how
playing,
long, but how long did that disruption last?
Well, usually a season. Yeah,
but
it took us years to get over. You know, losing Modric and Bale.
What I don't get is that you have in Slaven Bilic a manager who was a defender, and in his coaching staff he also has Julian Dix, who was a defender, and yet the defence.
So
is non-existent.
So is your issue, you could accept it if he wasn't scoring lots of goals, but the bare minimum, let's be defensively good. You're not even doing that.
We're not even doing that. And the fact is that this season we will end up with less points than we had when we sacked Allardyce. So we sacked Allardyce, I think, and we had 47 points at the end of that season, right? And we're currently on 38 with four games left. So all these West Ham fans will say Allardyce was crap and like he wasn't taking us anywhere. It's like, okay, fine. So he took us as far as he could, which was he got us up from in one season up from the Championship to the Premier League, and he kept us there for three seasons, right? So he's taken us that far. So now we need a new manager who's going to take us to the next level. And he did that last season. But now you've gone one step forward and then two steps back. So my argument is that, well, why have we not progressed? Like, we're in a new stadium. We've got a new manager. We haven't got Big Sam. And yet we're still going backwards in it, yeah. And that's the issue I have.
I think it's the fact you've got a new stadium and you lost your best player in the same season, and it's a stadium that has drained the life out of the atmosphere of the club at the moment. I'm sure they'll improve. They are working to improve it, and the more games you win, will improve it. I think you're right to say he needs at least half of next season. I don't know what he's supposed to do. I feel a lot of sympathy.
And the other thing is that you know, I think what a lot of people who aren't West Ham fans don't get and is that how monumentally awful and turgid the majority of our performances have been this season. Like, I've been to most of those games and they are pretty awful. Like, there's some of the worst. It's basic stuff. It's just like, you know, the number of times you see a pass just like go completely awry and just dribbles off and they're just like, oh no, it's gone off. Like, it's just, it's really bad football at some point. So it's not just like even the defence thing, it's just like there's just a lack of movement, there's a lack of imagination. And like, if it's all down to getting rid of Payet, then you have to have a complete rethink, which is was we just completely reliant on that one player? Mm-hmm. And is that all we can, you know, there's the thing about a manager should be is that you should turn a you should be able to, at least on the surface, take a whole team and make it greater than the sum of its parts. And I think that's what most decent managers can do with whatever they have.
Yeah. It's amazing.
And it feels like Bilic just can't do that. No. He just can't do it.
But it's amazing how few managers can and how many managers get away with just having two or three
Klopp's
worldies.
Not done it. Pep's not doing it.
But you know who is? A man called Sam Allardyce.
This is true. You mentioned the stadium.
You can't have him.
You mentioned the stadium earlier. Just on, actually. So is your issue the fact that, are you pissed off that you sacked Allardyce or that you appointed Bilic?
Both. Because I think, so there was always this, the thing about the owners, which I always found weird about Allardyce, is like they appointed him and no one was happy with it, including them. So it was always like, we're just getting him because we just want him to
He wasn't first choice, yeah.
And then Bilic wasn't first choice. Like, he was like our third.
I meant Bilic, sorry. Yeah.
Oh yeah, and then Bilic wasn't our first choice. He was like a third choice. So it's just that, why would you? Because they were ready to sack Allardyce way in advance, you know. He got sacked. We lost, I think, 2-0 against Newcastle at the end of the season, and the press release went out at 2 minutes past the final whistle.
It was rude.
So they were ready. Really, and then so you assume in that situation, like, oh, well, then they must instantly have a guy to replace him. But no, they have to go for the third guy along. Yeah. So it's just bad management again. It's bad management in knowing what to do with that football club. They just feel like a need to do something.
Just a couple more. The stadium thing, I think I mentioned to yourself when you were last on, or maybe another West Ham fan, the stadium thing, I wouldn't underestimate how big a factor that is as well. And what's worrying from an outside looking in is I don't think it will get any better, because the stadium is not going to next year be... I think the way the stadium is structured, I think there's a genuine problem, it seems, from the fans and the players on the pitch in terms of that kind of closeness, and it's not going to get any better because you're not going to change the stadium. Are you worried that dynamic between the fans, and West Ham, one of those clubs that the fans do seem to be very close to the players and the team, is that kind of like that closeness that's gone because just physically you're not near to the stadium? Are you worried that may be an ongoing issue?
I think it's always going to be a worry, and I think it will always be a reason why we might not love that stadium as much as we did the Bolin. I think the other 2 points are that you do notice actually when you watch a lot of European football that there are a lot of other stadiums around Europe which have got quite a distance between the fans and the pitch. So I don't think in the long run it will be that bad in terms of the performances.
No, I don't think it's an excuse for performances, yeah, but I think in terms of the fans,
yeah. But then I think the other thing is that I would really keep an eye out in terms of whether there will be a transformation of that stadium internally in terms of after the World Athletics Championships this summer, whether that running track is actually used. Because down the line, whether West Ham pays off something towards Newham Council or whatever, in terms of just being like, this running track is a complete load of rubbish, because you're never going to get 60,000 people there on a regular basis watching athletics. Yeah. Let's just get rid of it and completely reconfigure it into a football stadium, which can still be used for NFL or like concerts and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. So there's still some, you know, local community benefit towards it.
That sounds a little bit like the Tottenham plan for the Olympic Stadium that was rejected.
What? What was that?
Let's move forward. Quick ones. Lanzini, I like him a lot. Yeah. Is he someone that this time next year, we could be looking at and thinking Player of the Year contender? Is he a guy that's got a couple more levels?
I think definitely, especially when he's definitely the best player at the moment, and he always amazes me in that he's not just. He looks physically really weedy, and yet he has
Mahrez-esque.
He has this amazing, and but he's even shorter than Mahrez, so he's just like this like little tiny weedy guy. But he actually amazingly is such a good dribbler and has such power to muscle past people, which he did on numerous occasions against Everton. And I think once he has better players feeding off around him, then he'll be even better.
And finally, Andy Carroll. When he plays, he seems to be really loved by the fans. He seems to normally score and do well.
Yeah.
It's just not very often. Mm. Is he worth keeping? Are there more positives than negatives? Because again, he's on quite a big contract at West Ham.
Yeah.
Are the gains bigger than the losses with someone like Andy Carroll? Or could that money be invested in a striker that might not be quite as effective, but plays more games and he's more reliable?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like Andy Carroll, you always have to put your faith in that things might get better. And I think he has that. I just think he's worth having regardless, because I feel like he has that sort of Giroud quality of being able to just whack him on after 70 minutes and just... You know, I mean, at the end of the day, at some point, you're always going to need a bit of Route 1 football and just whack a ball in the box. And that's what he's good for. And I think he's just worth having, especially at a time when we don't really have that many, for a while, strikers who are reliable. And he's not particularly reliable, but he's still worth having.
Okay.
And I think he's got better. I think he's got better than just being a guy who just heads the ball. He's got much better hold-up play as well. Okay. So I think he's worth keeping hold of.
All right, chaps, let's move on now to talk about stadiums. And I want to know from you guys, which is the best stadium in the country and why? Now, are you guys regular travellers to stadiums up and down the country? Not really.
Not really. Lower league stuff. I did a lot when I was a kid. I grew up in Devon, so a huge amount of top-class football available.
Let's start with your two clubs then. Start with you, Kieran, on this one. Yeah. Obviously, you're relevant because...
Yeah, tell us about your stadium.
Where you've just moved to. Yours clearly isn't the best stadium in the country. Or is it?
It actually got voted best stadium in like Europe by some weird awards thing.
Well, this is
it's what growing on me anyway.
What are the top three most important things for you as a fan in visiting a stadium that are important to you? Forget the game, but going to a stadium, is it transport links? Is it the size? Is it the shape? Is it the aesthetics? What is important to you in terms of judging a stadium and a ground experience?
Well, I think all fans would probably agree that it's got to be your proximity to the pitch. And one of the things I found the most difficult adjusting to in the new stadium at West Ham is being so far away from the pitch. Because you're not really... The whole point about being close to the pitch is it feels like... Even though it just feels that whenever you shout or say something, it feels like you're having an influence and it feels like they can hear you. And you just get sort of a better general sense that you're part of going along rather than sort of a spectator at home. So the further back you are, the less inclined you feel to shout. The less you feel like you're part of it. So I think that's always been an important thing. And I think that's why those sort of old tight grounds where, you know, I think, I mean, I haven't been to that many, I mean, I've been to a lot in London, but, you know, like going to like the King Power, like last season, going there away for the West Ham game was great. So I think those are the most important things. I think that's why everyone always talks about Selhurst Park being the best sort of stadium, because it's still that sort of like, you know, just sort of a steep incline and everyone's sort of on top of you, which is why everyone liked the bowling ground. So I think that's, you know, it's a proximity to the pitch and sort of an old school ground. You know, no one likes the bowl shaped sort of stadium like London Stadium, like the Emirates. Like, you know, Arsenal fans still don't particularly love it.
I hate it. It's funny you mentioned that.
And people hate Wembley as well.
Oh, it's not that great. Worse. Yeah. KB, I was listening to a show or a podcast a few weeks ago, and one of the representatives asked a journalist, did this like quick fire thing, and it was like, what's the worst stadium to cover as a journalist? And the journalist that was talking, he said St Mary's, Southampton. And everyone's a bit shocked. What have they done to you? What's so bad about Southampton? And he said that he didn't like it because compared to what the old Dell was back in the day, he hates the fact that all these new stadiums look the same. They're all that kind of oval shape design.
We're joining the club.
And he just didn't like the stadium, considering what they had before. And I hadn't thought about that. And I thought, yeah, it's true. A lot of the new stadiums across Europe and definitely in England, they must have the same designer designing all their stadiums because they all look the same. And they all look like formulaic and kind of uniform. Do you think the shape of a stadium is that important?
I mean, aesthetically,
looks great, but not really effective.
Yeah, I mean, but that said, White Hart Lane looks terrible. So, I mean, I'm not going to miss the aesthetic of White Hart Lane. The atmosphere, though, if they don't get the atmosphere, it is a shell. If they get the atmosphere wrong, though, which is what I love about White Hart Lane, is the fact we are, you know, 3 or 4 feet away from the edge of the pitch. You can shout at people and think they can hear you. And more importantly, the acoustics are incredible. Mm. When Spurs fans sing, which isn't always, it's deafening, and it is a very intimidating place to go. Wembley, however, as we found at the start of the season, it sounds ridiculous, but trying to get a song going north to south side of the pitch, it gets lost halfway through. Nothing goes. So everyone's singing slightly out of time, different songs, and it's so flat. The atmosphere is awful. So, you know, I think a lot of money and time has been spent on making sure that our new stadium tries to, you know, capture the atmosphere of White Hart Lane. Whether or not we get it, I don't know. But
which is a good thing, because I think the aesthetics thing is okay. St Mary's might look exactly the same as Stadium of Light, and that might look exactly the same as the King Power. But, you know, when I went to the West Ham game recently and sat in another seat with another guy who's got a much better seat than me, and we were talking about what we think about the ground and, like, and, you know, it's growing on us, and he was like, you know, I just can't get over here, and like when I step out and just that view, it's amazing. And it is an amazing view when you step out. It's like an amazing view. But I, you know, who cares? Yeah. Like, it looks great. It doesn't sound great. We've only won like 5 games there. Like, you know, when we were interviewing Leroy Rossignol, you know, he was talking about, you know, it really matters to have, you know, the crowd, the home crowd, like on top of the opposition. It really matters. So I think the aesthetics, you know, I mean, I don't think it matters that much. I mean, you know, I think the Alliance is an amazing stadium aesthetically, but they've also got the insides right as well.
I don't think the aesthetics, that's where you guys were let down, wasn't it? Because, you know, the Olympics forced your hand, and you've been pushed into a stadium that you can't change. Whereas I think most clubs now, if they are going to build the bowl, they get the insides right. So, you know, Spurs are building, I think it's the largest single tier stand, certainly in England, and it's going to rival the one in Dortmund. So we're going to have our own cop. And I think if you are building a stadium and you're not thinking about how do you bring that intensity and that passion as close to the pitch as possible, then you're letting your fans down. As, you know, the Emirates was built probably a little bit too soon.
Too early, yeah. A couple of stadiums that I've not been to, but my favourite stadium from a fan's point of view is definitely Selhurst Park. I've not been there about 15 years. But the thing about Selhurst Park and the Kop to a degree as well, is even on TV, they just seem loud. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they're quite cute with the microphones near the fan and they kind of work that, but they just seem, it could be as boisterous and as rowdy and as they seem to go as any other stadium. But they just seem to make so much noise, and I love that. Mm. I really, really love that. The acoustics there, I don't know if it's because it's an old ground. Everton as well, Goodison Park on TV. When it really gets rocking, they get it loud in a way that the Emirates is never that loud. I'm like, even when we score a goal, we reach a certain peak of volume from the fans, but we never like, it's deafening in here sort of thing in the way that the Kop seems on TV sometimes.
But that's a combination of the aesthetics and the new facilities with what type of fans are coming. Selhurst Park is like an old school ground, how it always has been. It's not designed for your tourists who are coming over. And I'm not saying it's a bad thing to have tourists come to stadiums, but they will change the atmosphere and the makeup of what it sounds like. So, you know, the Olympic Stadium is designed, we've got popcorn if you want popcorn, you know. It's got great transport links. It's got all these things which make it accessible. Yeah. Not just to West Ham fans, but to other people.
It's the greatest ground until you get inside.
Yeah, exactly.
what Selhurst Park needs is a cheese room. And as soon as all Premier League clubs adopt one, you'll see the benefit, I'm
what
sure.
What is this cheese room all about?
If you're willing to spend $100,000 on two tickets for a season, you have access to the cheese room and a Michelin. I mean, it's nonsense.
Yeah, but I quite like the two-way single.
I mean, that's quite fun. There's the tunnel that you could see the players like cajoling each other and swearing at each other and making jokes, but they can't see you.
Taking like selfies and stuff like that in front of it, or just like making faces.
But for us mere mortals, though, I don't think we'll ever see
that kind of thing. Just finally, and are you a fan, you guys, of things like music in stadiums? I mean, like after goals, clappers, flags, all those things that in theory add to an atmosphere, but some people think they're quite cheesy.
We were at Craven Cottage
and they got the
couple weeks ago, and they got the clappers and they had music playing right up to kickoff. And it was quite fun. I don't think I'd want it after a goal.
I wouldn't ever want it after a goal. Isn't it PSG who had that? What was the Champions League game where they scored? I think it was PSG, and they played Uptown Funk.
Oh no!
And it was like really, really, really weird.
Oh no!
I mean, it's fine to have music at the end of the game.
Yeah.
Because like, I always remember Leinoyen. They used to always play whenever they used to win a game. They used to always play "Rocking All Over the World" by Status Quo. Similarly at West Ham, whenever they win, they always play "Shake It On Baby" by the Beatles. Like that's fine, but I mean, like,
but during games, that sort of thing.
No, I mean, they do that in, like, beach volleyball.
I don't think you need it. I think that's where a good atmosphere... If you're covering it with sound and music, it's because your stadium's rubbish.
That's a good point. And just finally, which stadium would you say, having been to or seen on TV, would you say that's the best stadium in the country?
The London Stadium.
The London Stadium. Was clearly joking.
I'll leave the reaction to that.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I haven't been to that many... I mean, you know...
Newcastle?
Stoke. I mean, I've heard Newcastle's great. I'm going to Stoke on Saturday,
Stoke
actually, so I can tell you after that.
Well, Stoke apparently 2-3 years ago, their stadium won is an award as well for the loudest stadium in the country.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
So I will let you know on Saturday.
Let me know if your ear drums.
Old Trafford's the other one. I'd love to. I've still not been.
How is not meant to be that good though?
Yeah.
Even it's like,
well, like 5 or so years, but that might be kind of to your earlier point about new generation of fans going there. On TV, which stadium do you look at and think?
Selhurst Park's
rocking,
it's amazing.
Isn't it?
Yeah. I love the atmosphere. The togetherness of the fans is great.
And it also looks petrifying whenever one of the away team goes to take a corner from that one end.
Like a metre away on
there. That corner of people are just like absolutely berating them.
All right, guys, let's now move on to something that I've been keeping half an eye on for a few weeks now. And I wanted to get a supporter on the FFP to kind of just give me some kind of clarification on what's going on and what's happening at Leighton Orient. We don't normally discuss teams out of the Premier League, but I think that this is part of something that is bigger than just kind of the football club itself, and a problem that I think we're noticing at different clubs across the Football League. I want to bring in Tom, who's the vice chair of the Leighton Orient Fans Trust. How are we doing, Tom?
Hi, not too bad, considering.
Yeah, it's not good times at your club right now. For those that don't know what's going on at Leighton Orient, just give us a little bit of a timeline of what's happened over the last 12 months and where you currently are at the moment.
Well, obviously on Saturday we got relegated out of the Football League, which was a big shock for the first time. And this is obviously not something we were expecting 3 years ago when we were on the verge of getting promoted to the Championship. But with the last 3 years we've been owned by Italian businessman called Francesco Bacchetti, who's basically destabilised the club. It's probably the most kind way of putting it. He initially spent quite a lot of money, but there's a lot of reports of meddling in the team. And in the last season or so, there's been a kind of gradual, since Christmas, there's been a complete withdrawal of funding. Players have been forced out. We've been forced to play the youth team in most of them, a youth team dominated team in the last couple of months. And players and staff haven't been paid. The last time we heard reports they were paid was at the end of February. So it feels like the whole club's kind of been sort of starved of funds, and then we had a winding up order last month as well. So it's not just a case of someone finishing bottom of the league, because someone's got to finish bottom of the league every year. But the manner in which this has happened has been a kind of sabotage of the club almost, and it raises questions about how owners are allowed to get away with things really in football. But
and so what's the current state at the moment then with the owner? What's his stance?
Well, he said he's put the club up for sale. There's been reports of, you know, interested bidders. He's a very difficult man to pin down in terms of actually striking a deal and getting everything kind of sorted out. So in the meantime, we've had a winding up order which was adjourned in March over an unpaid tax bill. That was the tax bill side of it was met, but there are still other creditors, which range from the local council to the programme printers, and the photographer hasn't been paid and things like that. But there's still people that are owed money, creditors, and we've actually, as a trust of them, have been representing some of those and been in contact with them and with small shareholders of the club to see if we can kind of act to kind of make a transfer of ownership possible. So it's been it's been heavy stuff, really.
That doesn't sound good. Does your owner, did he have a history before he took over your club of bad business practices, or is this just an isolated incident where
he'd never been involved in English football before? He ran a volleyball club in Italy, which was briefly successful and then folded. So that's a bit of a kind of slight red light there, a bit of an alarm. That was in the early 2000s. His background is his sort of family money comes from sort of the Italian energy and waste management sector, and it's quite hard to find out much about him, really. And it's not quite sure what businesses of his are actually operational, and where the money comes from, and so on, where the money was coming from, because there's not any money coming in at all now. But he's not someone who is, and also he's completely unaccountable. He doesn't do media interviews. He's done one very tightly controlled meeting with fans, but it was like vetted questions and things like that. So he's not an easy person to pin down, really.
So is your club on the verge, or what's going to happen to Leonore now? Are you done, or is it?
There's been a very concerted campaign. Everyone's been campaigning to save the club, and obviously everyone's kind of animated by that. So everyone's kind of rallying around, and we're trying to sort of seek out investors, and we're seeking out, you know, we've actually drawn up recovery plans and business plans ourselves about what sort of might be needed. And hopefully we can get a change of ownership and get a change of ownership in which fans have a stake in the club, because that's sort of our fundraising, which we've done a lot of fundraising for a sort of fighting regeneration fund in the last 2 months, which had great donations from all over the country, other fans as well. And the idea about that is to actually give us to meet some contingencies in the event of a change of ownership, and to possibly give us a stake, a fans' democratic stake in the club. So it's kind of changing the sort of club, you know, becoming a better club as a result of it. And we've had a great response to that from our fans and from other fans, including other London fans and big club fans as well.
Hi Tom. I saw today that Barry Hearn, has he resigned from his position on the honorary president or something?
He was made honorary president when he sold the club to Bichetti 3 years ago.
Yeah.
It's basically an honorary position. He hasn't been involved at all since then.
I was wondering two things. Is there any bad feeling from the Orient fans about Barry Hearn letting the club go to Pichetti? And also, the weird thing about it for me is, like, what does he get out of this? Or why did he want this club? And why does he want to just drive it, you know, into nothingness?
Well, I'll answer the Barry Hearn question first. Barry has been blamed a little bit for not doing his homework on the guy he sold to and being a bit too hasty in the sale. But to be fair to him, he's kind of put his hands up on that. And that's why he resigned as honorary president today. I think his view was he can't be associated with anything as toxic as this. The non-payment of staff issue was the final straw. And he has been outspoken in criticising Bekessi in the last few months. But there is obviously people are sort of saying that, you know, that I think he feels a bit penitent. Hearn feels a bit penitent that actually he did sell us to this guy. But so he's been kind of fairly approachable lately, actually, and he's someone. I mean, I don't think he wants to come back into to run the club, but he's someone that obviously because his company owns the ground and pension the company. His company pension scheme now owns the ground, so there's still contact between us and him, and you know, it's a reasonable relationship there. In terms of what Piketty was is motivated by, I think it was a sort of, I mean, it's hard to say because he won't say anything, but it's a sort of element to which he sort of acted like a sort of spoiled kid with a toy, and so when he first got it, he kind of splashed money about and meddled, and he, you know, that's why he sacked 11, you know, we've got to 11 managers in 3 years, so he kind of sacks people as and when. And various managers have complained about interference in team selection. So he's kind of like a spoiled rich kid playing with a toy, and now he's kind of people started to protest against him. A sense that he's kind of thrown that toy out of the pram, and saying, "Well, I don't want man, nothing." You know. He's kind of an autocrat, really. He doesn't really want to, you know, listen to anyone. Oh. But yeah, I mean, it's hard to say what the motivation is and why, and you know, so much stuff that isn't known about where his money comes from, why he sunk it in the first place, where, you know, what his business interests are up to. So it's really difficult.
Yeah. And just one other quick question. Ever since, you know, Brighton got promoted and Portsmouth also got promoted, there's been this sort of narrative, I think, in the media recently of, isn't it great all these clubs where, you know, the fans have got together, you know, well, with Portsmouth, the fans got together, and Brighton, the whole history from back in the 80s. The one thing about the Lane Orient story is I feel like it just hasn't got that much media coverage. Do you feel like while that whole happy narrative about all those clubs doing really well is going on, no one's focusing on Orient as much?
It's taken a while for people to focus on us. I mean, it's been quite a lot. I mean, partly when people have done stories about bad ownership and crises and stuff, there's been quite a few this season. There's been Blackburn, there's been Charlton, there's been Coventry. So we're kind of in a kind of queue of teams that get spotlighted. Obviously, with our plight, I think we always want to get more attention. I mean, I think there's probably more anger amongst Orient fans really towards the football authorities because they seem to be completely helpless about regulating this situation, and you know, their owner and directors' tests. There has to be some question marks over that now, because they're just, you know, if you can get away with not even paying the staff and not even get a disrepute charge and not even get, you know, considered and you're still considered fit and proper, then they've got to look about their rules, how they implement them, and that kind of thing. So, and also, to be fair to Brighton and Portsmouth, I think all the fans generally say, well, good luck to them. That's actually inspirational for us, because it shows that when you're right at the bottom, you can still, if you fight for your club, as they did, they can turn it around. I mean, they're bigger clubs than us, but the sort of moral of the story is the same, really. And I think I sort of feel quite pleased for Brighton, really, even though we had quite a rivalry with them a few years ago. I mean, you know, good luck to them.
Hi, Thomas, the other Kieran here, mate. I was just wondering, how far down the line are you guys at finding other buyers? I mean, I'm assuming your trust is quite active in that. Or is it, are you looking more at a club-owned structure, fan-owned structure in future?
I think there are buyers. We have had some contact ministers. There's all sorts of confidentiality arrangements around interests in the club. And it's, you know, you can't really kind of completely to get to the nub of that, but I mean, I think probably realistically we're looking at something to like there probably would be some sort of owner and us with a stake, 20% or something like that, but we have to sort of take these things as they come and see who's around. I mean, if the absolute worst came to the worst and the club got liquidated and there was no takeover or anything like that, then obviously we'll have no real choice but to consider the Phoenix Club option and, you know, put that to our membership and then start from there. And it would be, and then obviously in that situation it would be an entirely fan-owned club. But I think it's always what we've been loft. The Fans Trust has existed for 16 years and we've always kind of lobbied for and supported the idea of at least a supporter stake in the club, so we would have at least some element of an elected director and some input that, you know, and something that also safeguards the club from having a majority shareholder like we currently have.
Tom, just a final one for me. I mean, before I ask my final question, I was at a conference today and FA chairman Greg Clark was there and he was asked a question about ownership and that sort of thing with clubs. And you mentioned a couple of clubs that are going through similar, if not potentially down the line, more so with their owners, you know, your Blackburns and Blackpool as well, to name a couple. And he made the point that there's not really much the FA can do in terms of intervening in situations where there's clear bad practices going on from owners in clubs. If there's, in terms of who picks up and buys those clubs, if there's a willing buyer and a willing seller, there's not anything the FA can really do to kind of beyond the business practices of fit and proper persons act. They can't do anything really more than just kind of let it happen, really, which is a shame. So I think we're probably going to unfortunately see more instances where more clubs are bought by businessmen and they're just used as toys and that sort of thing as well, which is a real shame. But my final question is, as a fan of a club in the Premier League, I've always wondered, I hear this kind of thing quite often as well. When I hear, I thought Arsenal, that's my club, and Arsenal's always whinging, we're always moaning about not winning the Premier League, not winning this, we lost to this team, lost to this team, we finished top four every year, and we're still whinging and moaning. As a fan of a team that's, you know, on the verge of potentially going under, how does it make you and your fellow Leinonian fans feel when you hear Premier League clubs whinging about things that to you must seem like, you know, so far away? Or do you accept and understand that different clubs have different standards and different expectations?
Well, I think we sort of mock it, really. I mean, the Arsenal thing, I think a lot of people have taken the mick out of Arsenal this season.
We do too.
A couple of Leinonian fans made a sort of viral YouTube video about sort of expressing their sincere sympathies to Arsenal when they were at this rally at Arsenal, let's have a collection for Arsenal.
I saw that, yeah.
All that kind of thing. So I guess it's sort of mockery, really, because I think people kind of look at the top of the Premier League and think there's quite a lot of entitlement there. And obviously everyone has their own different standards that they accept that they want their team to aspire to. And if I was an Arsenal fan, I'd probably feel a bit frustrated and bored at always coming fourth, but not doing anything more than that. Although you are in the cup final again, which is obviously great. It gets mocked a bit. I don't think necessarily people think Arsenal fans are the enemy, because obviously all football fans kind of sympathise with each other. We've really seen that. We did a collection at Spurs a couple of weeks ago, and Spurs fans are great, actually. I mean, they sort of, you know.
Did you chip in, Kieran?
Got a goodwill to us. In terms of what Greg Clark said about owners and stuff, I mean, if he is saying that, he's almost admitting that their owners and directors' test is inadequate, then he can't really complain if Parliament starts threatening legislation, because that's the other. If they're saying they're powerless, then the only way you can actually beef that up is actually government legislation. They obviously, and they're scared of that, so they have to kind of look at the situation and say, well, shrugging your shoulders isn't enough.
Really. Not good enough, no. Well, Tom, we wish you all the best of luck with trying to raise the funds necessary to, well, first of all, pay the staff that haven't been paid for 2-3 months. That really is foul. But on a long-term basis, hopefully you get the kind of financial stability that will see your club not only survive, but in the long term, hopefully thrive. As you mentioned earlier on, you lot were on the verge of getting to the Championship just a few years ago, and to see where you are now is not really cool. And as a Londoner, I don't want to see any London clubs or any clubs go under. So thanks for coming on the FFP, Tom, and yeah, all the best.
Okay, thanks very much.
Good luck, Tom.
Cheers, mate.
Cheers, Tom.
Good luck.
Cool. All right. Spurs. Let's talk about Tottenham Hotspur.
Let's.
My favourite worst subject. Kieran, your time.
This is like the most hostile environment for these questions.
Yes.
The chippy West Ham.
Your two biggest rivals. when will Spurs step up?
I mean, that question alone says everything I need to know about the line of questioning.
He's already angry.
I think we are stepping up. I think we're in the process of stepping up. I don't think it happens overnight. And I think we're ahead of where I certainly expected us to be under Pochettino. And I think it's been a weird one, because last year was such an anomaly with Leicester winning the title, us essentially being the only rival to them until we imploded after we lost our opportunity to win the league. But when the traditional top four, top five fell away, it was clear that something was going on at Spurs that was quite impressive. And I think that has accelerated everything. I think the players thrived off being seen as a top team. Pochettino's almost certainly used that to go and get the players he wanted in the summer, and there's just an excitement, there's a buzz around not just the squad, which is the most together squad I've ever seen in my lifetime. They clearly like each other, they clearly like the manager, but the fans are the most behind the manager in a team I've ever seen, and it's exciting to watch. You know, I live literally 150 yards up the road from the new stadium, and there is, you know, this physical representation of what seems to be Tottenham building something new and strong and sustainable, which is really exciting. But what was it, 8 or 7 semi-finals in a row?
I think.
But I don't want to get caught up in this Spursy thing, because I started it earlier. Spurs fans are not confident ever. We've got history of messing things up. This is the most quietly confident I've ever been about Tottenham side. It's the most enjoyable football I've watched, certainly since Bale and Modric were at the
Harry
club.
Redknapp.
Yeah, I was never the biggest fan of Redknapp. I probably sound like Kieran talking about Bilic, but I never bought into Redknapp. Okay. He seemed to me that his only solution to a problem was to spend a lot of money, and he had the wrong chairman for that. And he'd seen, you know, you look at what Harry Redknapp's done at every club he's been at, he's left them in a hole. And Daniel Levy wasn't going to let him do that to Spurs. That said, Harry Redknapp had the most gifted individuals that we've had at the club.
Yeah.
Possibly. I mean, Gareth Bale is the best player I've ever seen in my life live.
Yeah.
And Luka Modric wasn't far off.
Yeah.
So he had a pretty good squad to work with. And I don't think he ever achieved what he could have done. Whereas I think Pochettino's got a less gifted squad overall. Don't get me wrong, Ali's going to be a pretty special player. Mm. Harry Kane's turning out to be an exceptional striker.
Mm.
But it's the togetherness of the team. It's the way that they've bought into this high press, high energy, swift, you know, transition football that we're playing. And I can't believe I'm saying this, the best defence in the league.
Mm. I've actually been quite complimentary and quite, I'm able to put my anti-Tottenham hat down every now and again. And I was actually quite complimentary. And I have been over the last, probably about a year, about Tottenham's, how they're playing. And you seem to be going the right direction. Defensively, I think Tottenham are really, really good. You clearly have attacking prowess, and you can score goals, and you're good to watch and all of that. There doesn't seem to be this obvious expectedness that when you play a big team, you're going to always definitely lose it. You do still lose some big games, but there's not this, like Spurs. It's Spurs, United going to win. It's Arsenal, United. It's Arsenal, Spurs. Arsenal going to win it in the way there has been in the past. However, in a season that's going to be potentially your greatest ever Premier League season, there's still no trophy. And
but then there's not been trophies all my life. You know, I'm 32 now, and I've seen us win. I can remember us winning 2 of the 3 or 4 trophies we've won in my lifetime. So no, there hasn't been trophies. And this is not an excuse for Pochettino if he's not won a trophy at any club. That said, he's always been at clubs that weren't the best in the league when he joined them. And we're still punching well below the rest of the top 5, 6 in terms of how much money we spend on wages and how much money we bring in as a club. Until we get that new stadium, we aren't at the same level. So it's not all about money, obviously. But I feel like the foundations to go and win trophies are being laid right now. And if he doesn't win anything next season or the season after, if he stays that long, then yeah, it would be a huge missed opportunity, I think. I will be very disappointed if we haven't won some silverware with him.
Did you see that loss on the weekend against Chelsea as a really big missed opportunity, in that there was possibly a double whammy? You could have got to a cup final, but you could have also laid some psychological scars on Chelsea's Premier League running as well. And it was the moment, it felt to me like, if Tottenham are going to do something, now is the time to, as I said, step up and get over that hump and really just show us you're not just about... I saw an article from Sam Wallace in the Telegraph, and there was a line in it that he said that this was the team that has now become the greatest at dominating games against a team that is now the greatest at winning games and just getting the job done. Do you know what I mean? And
absolutely,
that kind of summed it up, really. Tottenham played, I thought, really, really well, as you did against Chelsea in the first game, in the first half, where you collect the equalizer. You were great. That's probably the first best 45 minutes I've seen this whole season. You were great that half at Stamford Bridge. but yet he's still winning at 1-1, and then that just gave him into Chelsea.
Yeah, yeah.
Is it not concerning that you're playing well and you're still not?
That's a great line? No, but I think that's a great example. The difference between us and Chelsea at the moment are Eden Hazard, Pedro. It's the players who've gone and won everything already,
yeah,
and are £100 million players in the case of Eden Hazard and whatever Pedro's worth. You know, that is the difference. It's that experience of winning things at the highest level. We don't have that, unfortunately. And you know, it's not ideal to see coming off the bench Thiago Costa, Eden Hazard, and Cesc Fabregas.
No,
three players who would walk into, I would say, pretty much certainly any Premier League team now, and in the case of Fabregas and Hazard, maybe any Premier League team in history. So that wasn't ideal. And at 2-2, we were definitely the better side. It was just so frustrating that we'd given away two very sloppy goals. You know, Toby Alderweireld made a foul, his ninth of the season, I think. He doesn't do that, and they scored because Willian's a very good player. And Son should not have been playing. The biggest mistake of the week, tactically, certainly, was Son playing the wing back role, which he's not good enough to do defensively. But we were crowbarring in our maybe most informed player. Ben Davies had a knock, apparently, and that formation has done very well against Chelsea earlier on in the season. So look, we're not there yet. We aren't there yet, but we're pushing. We're the only team as well who've consistently pushed for the last two seasons. I am just loath to get carried away, though, and I'm not going to start criticising us for not winning something when I've never seen a team that's actually got the potential to do what I think they have. So, if you know, I feel like if we'd been where Arsenal were for 15 years, I'd be getting annoyed right now.
Yeah,
but we're not there yet. We're at the very beginning of something, I hope, and I hope we keep that squad together, because what they'll be in 5 years' time is potentially very, very exciting.
Because also, isn't the most important thing is that, as unfair as Saturday's result might have felt, i.e. dominating, it felt unfair that Chelsea had like four shots and one. It was a loss, which was like a loss which is okay to take because you played really well.
Absolutely.
Where it's not like, you know, being 2-0 up against Arsenal and then losing 5-2. It's not like capitulating to Newcastle at the end of last season. It's a completely different. It's not doing a Spurs. It's playing well and getting unlucky, which is what happens in football. It's not doing a Spurs. So it's not the whole, like, the old, oh, it's Spurs, they're going to mess it up. It was just like, this is a new Spurs.
It was the least Spurs-y
trying to get used to being
loss.
Well,
that I've seen in
loss.
A big competition.
Trying to get used to dominating games, which is, in some ways.
Which like, is why that whole idea, the whole idea of being, you know, was it 8 semi-finals in a row? None of those players, with the exception, I think, of Kyle Walker, played in the last semi-final we lost to Chelsea, which we got absolutely hammered in. I mean, admittedly, there was a goal that wasn't a goal, but we were outplayed, outclassed. AVB was outclassed time and time again by the top sides when he was Spurs manager. Like you say, Pochettino hasn't been blown away by any side. I would say our biggest problem this season was just our slow start. You know, it really cost us. I think we drew 8 games in the first half of the season. That was probably tiredness from the Euros. Our key players were missing. Eriksen, Ali and Kane weren't really at the races early on. Then Kane got injured. You know, we didn't start a season as a side that you would look at now and be like, oh, well, those guys could win the title. We certainly did not look like a title-winning side for the first 10 games. But that's what I'm so excited about, is that the togetherness of the squad was there. Mm. Pochettino trusted his players and the way that we play. And from Christmas onwards, with the exception of Liverpool and Sunderland, we've been outstanding, and I would say the best team in the league. So I'm excited that the team didn't lose belief, that they still think that there is a way of winning this league. And as Kieran says, you know, that result on Saturday, if it happened last year, I'd have been really, really worried. But I don't think they're going to lose confidence. We've got a hell of a run in. We're going to go to Palace on Wednesday, and there literally isn't a worse team to go to at the moment.
No,
I think they are now the form side.
Yeah.
And then we've got you at the weekend. We've got Arsenal at the weekend, and North London derbies, as everyone knows, it doesn't matter what your form is.
Mm.
I could see both those games, by the way, being a draw. And I wouldn't be totally distraught if they were both draws. I just think we need to win every game if we want to win the league, and I don't see us doing that, and I don't see Chelsea dropping 4 points even.
What do they need to do next season to kind of really kick on now? Because it's been 2 years now in the top three. This year's looking like top two. What do they need to do next year? Because let's assume that Pep's going to go crazy this summer. Jose's going to go crazy this summer. If we said earlier about Wenger, this year might be the year that he goes crazy this summer, spending wise. If Klopp gets top four, they're going to spend. How do Spurs make sure that they at the least maintain what they're doing now, if not kick on to win that league now?
But I don't know how much Spurs fans necessarily feel they need to spend. I don't know whether what we're talking about here and the comparisons is about confidence and experience. And if Spurs are going to do what I think most teams should do, which is put trust and faith in younger players, then it's not a process of being like getting scared by what others are doing and therefore rashing to spend loads of money. It's more being confident in what you have, knowing the tweaks you need to make, and learning from this season to push on. So I don't know. Not as a non-Spurs fan, where you think you need to splash the cash, but if you see yourselves at the moment as more of a confidence thing, it's more just about making sure this team grows and gets more confident and ensures
the process and believes in what they're doing.
Yeah, and is in that process, because surely you would feel that if you started splashing the cash, that would
go against
that would disrupt the things, which is what happened at West Ham. It's not a comparison because we aren't anywhere near as good, but the minute you start trying to be like, oh, okay, so we did really well last season, so now let's just spend loads of money and just like mix it all up, it just doesn't work. It unsettles it completely.
You tried that, didn't you, with the Bale money?
Yeah, and
that was awful.
Yeah, it wasn't ideal, but I think the key thing is keeping all of our players. You know, we've got to stop being a selling club.
Well,
that's
my final question. Do you have concerns this summer that a United, a Real Madrid, a City might take your Rose, Alderweireld, an Ali, a Kane?
I don't think we would sell to a Premier League club. I think the only worry I think in Premier League with Premier League clubs is Walker maybe going to City, because I think they'd offer crazy money and him crazy money. But realistically, I don't think Spurs players would look at the Premier League at the moment and think, I've got no chance of winning something with this team, so I'm going to leave. If a Real Madrid or a Barcelona come in, Eriksen was linked with Barcelona earlier on in the week by Stan Collymore, of all people. But, you know, that's where I get a bit more worried, because Dele Alli will be on the radar of these clubs in the next few years. And it's hard to say no to the best teams in the world. I think they trust Pochettino. I think most of them want to play in the new stadium. I actually think the biggest threat to the project, in inverted commas, is the fact that we might have to play at Wembley for a year.
Yeah, as we mentioned on the pod before, from other Spurs fans that have said, the single biggest threat to a challenge next year isn't going to be players or even the manager, or as you mentioned, what other teams may do. It's Wembley.
Yeah,
that'll be their biggest obstacle.
It's the big unknown, and we haven't adapted well this year when we did play there. And I think the worst thing that could happen.
We won a game at Wembley this year. Sorry,
we did. We won against CSK Moscow in a dead rubber game. But that's the biggest threat. That's the biggest threat, because if you end up outside the top, you know, 4 or 5 next year, and you miss out on Champions League football, then you're going into your new stadium without Champions League football. Yeah. Then your players start thinking, oh, well, I'm not going to get those heady European nights next year. Yeah. Real Madrid might want me, or Man City might want me. Yeah. I can go and play for Guardiola, you know, all these enticing names and stuff. That gets tricky. Yeah. But, you know, what are you going to do? We've got to go somewhere. I'm really hoping for a last minute we're going to stay at White Hart Lane for another season. I've heard quiet rumours that might be what they're trying to do, but we'll see.
We will see. We'll see indeed. Well, yeah, we'll see next year how Spurs do. I think Spurs will be an interesting project, because I like Pochettino. I like what he's doing there. And he's doing something that I think a lot of other managers should be doing, and that's coaching. I think your Peps and your Jose's, it's all about spending big money. But what happened to coaching players and making a good player great, making a crap player good? Do you know what I mean? And just making... That's, for me, the two things that define a coach and a manager: how much you win, and can you make someone better? You know what I mean? Those are the main two things for me. And I think Pochettino has shown that he can make a player better. And I hope that he continues to do that, even though it's Spurs. And I hope he does that so much they get poached and taken away by other clubs.
Well, yeah, no, I think Pochettino will be really successful at Barcelona.
He's already said no.
Yeah, if Barcelona make that phone call and say, let's see what he says then. Yeah. Kieran, thank you very much for coming on the FFP this week. It's been really, really good having you guys here. First time. Hopefully you'll come back at some point. If not between now and the end of the season, at some point next season. I'd love to get you back on. All the best with West Ham. I really mean that. All the best with Spurs. I don't mean that in the slightest.
Well, especially not with next Sunday coming up.
This is true.
We didn't even talk about the derby.
No, yeah. Let's, maybe that's best. That's probably a good thing. Cheers, guys. Don't forget to subscribe to the Football Fans Podcast via the iTunes library, Football Fans Podcast, and also we're on SoundCloud, soundcloud.com/footballfanspodcast. Until next week, peace.